91.3 WLRN presents Topical Currents. We're in our At Your Service mode this hour with Condominium and Homeowners Association law expert Donna Berger. Good afternoon, Joseph Cooper here. There are some new wrinkles for condo associations. The Florida legislature has given permission for condo elections to be conducted online. This would include the often contentious contest for board members with certain guidelines. Are they a good idea or a potential boondoggle? There are also now regulations which sanction penalties for owners passing off regular pets as service animals. Donna Berger will explain the rules. Of course, we're ready for your questions and comments. Stay tuned. Topical Currents at Your Service next after NPR and Regional News. And we're back. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper with you. Once again, Bonnie Berman's a little bit under the weather. We think she'll be back tomorrow. Well, this hour we're in our At Your Service mode about condo and homeowners association issues. With us is regular contributor and attorney Donna Ballman. She's a legal expert on the subject. With more than two decades of experience in Florida, she's versed in legislative actions in the state, and she's a shareholder in the law firm of Becker and Polyakov. Welcome back to you, Donna Ballman.
Thanks,
Donna
Joe.
Berger. I'm sorry. Donna Ballman is another attorney.
Who's Donna Ballman?
She's our employment attorney.
It's good to
Forgive
be back.
Me.
Thanks, Joe.
Another senior error there. Our telephone number, if you have questions about condo or homeowners association issues, 800-743-9576. That's 800-743-9576. The issue of condo elections now being allowable online, how is that working out? What are the possibility and what are the pitfalls?
It is a very hot topic of discussion right now, Joe. The Florida legislature last session passed a new law that will allow association members to cast votes online. And that can either be a vote for electing their directors or it could be any other kind of vote, material alteration vote, amending the documents, a vote to waive reserves. Naturally, this is still developing. The Department of Business and Professional Regulation just released some proposed rules with regard to what needs to be in the board resolution if they want to offer it. From a practical standpoint, what's going to happen is this is probably going to take some time to catch on. Boards cannot force their members just to vote electronically. They have to offer both methods. So they have to offer the regular manual method to cast a vote. And if they want to offer electronic voting, they can do that. But for a while, it's going to be a hybrid. I don't know if you're ever going to get 100% participation for online voting, but we do think that over the next 5 years, you're going to see a lot of people start casting votes online.
Will more people then participate in the association, do you think?
Well, that is absolutely the hope, that if it's made more convenient that you can cast your vote online, that more people will participate, particularly in the election of directors. You know, that's where we hear most of the problems. The board's doing this or the board's not doing that. So if people feel that they're going to have an easier option when it comes to electing their volunteer board of directors, perhaps that is also going to play a significant role in reducing problems down the road.
Again, our telephone number, if you have comments or questions, 1-800-743-9576. Also, email, that's radio@wlrn.org. radio@wlrn.org. Of course, this wouldn't be any panacea for existing problems in condo associations.
No, but it's just another step in the right direction. We're embracing technology. One of the other changes last session was the ability to transmit proxies by email. So you can scan and email your proxy. This becomes a big issue. We have a lot of people in Florida that live elsewhere, at least part of the year. So if you're forced to put things back and forth in the mail, you have time constraints.
So by a proxy, you own a condo and you're renting it out. But you're voting in the...
No, if I buy a proxy, we're taking a vote, and I'm voting by limited proxy. So I'm filling out my proxy, I'm sending in my vote and giving it to the proxy holder who's going to attend the meeting and cast the vote for me. But last session, the law was changed to allow people to transmit those proxies by email, electronically, rather than having to stick them in the mail. And this helps because we do have a lot of people in Florida who own condos and homes and homeowners associations who live elsewhere.
Now, could some of these associations also maybe form their own kind of a chat area or something like that you could bring up issues, noise or...
Yeah, that's a really great point.
Parking, that's always a big contention.
Parking, pets, emotional support animals, yes. Some communities do have Joe chat rooms, and they're very sophisticated, and they do take advantage of various social media portals, whether it's a Facebook page or association website with chat room functionality. It all depends on the community. I mean, as I drove down here to your studio, I'm looking at high-rise condos. A lot of those communities and high-rise cooperatives, a lot of those communities do embrace technology, and they do have a very strong social media presence. If you have a small homeowners association with not a lot of amenities, you may not have the need for that kind of function.
So down the road, it could be that there could end formal board meetings?
Depends what you mean by formal board meetings. If it requires people to be there, you won't find most people at a board meeting. Will it end it? No. I think in terms of good governance, every association board needs to be meeting regularly. And those meetings, except for the areas where they can close it to the members, need to be duly noticed and they need to be opened. And the best communities are the ones that really embrace transparency.
What are the rules for board meetings as far as when owners can attend or not, or if it's just private between board members?
We get asked that a lot about executive session. All board meetings have to be duly noticed and open to the members with certain exceptions. And those are sessions are when the board is meeting with their attorney and they're going to be discussing pending or proposed litigation, or if the board is meeting to discuss personnel issues. So if they're meeting to discuss any of their association employees, their contracts coming up, their salaries, anything like that. Other than that, we get asked a lot about executive session. The board wants to take executive session. There is really no such thing. Those meetings have to be opened. Whenever you have a quorum of the board members present and discussing association business, you have a board meeting taking place for all intents and purposes, and your members need to know about it. And even when you can close a meeting, you still need to notify your members that you're holding a closed meeting, even if they can't attend.
So it could be personnel issues, as you remarked.
Personnel and litigation are the areas where you can close the meetings.
How much notice has to be given before a board meeting can be held?
If it's a regular board meeting, 48 hours. If it's a special board meeting, let's say the board is meeting to pass a special assessment, you'll need 14 days advance notice. And boards need to, sometimes your documents require more notice, but in terms of the statute, it's 48 hours for a regular meeting. Sometimes your documents will require more, but for special meetings, it's going to depend on the nature of the meeting.
Let's take some telephone calls. Our number 1-800-743-9576, also email radio@wlrn.org. First up, Fort Lauderdale caller. This is Saba.
Yes.
You need to turn down your radio, please.
Oh, yes. I thought, okay.
There you go.
Want to miss anything.
You're on with Donna Berger.
Hello?
Go ahead, ma'am.
Hello. Hi. I'm having a problem with a president. Disgruntled president. He's also himself in the position of office manager. I voted for him from the start 4 years ago, but recently we had an encounter. He verbally threatened to, quote, ruin my name in the building. No way he can do that. Not with the people who count, anyway. And he's threatened to, quote, make life difficult for me in the building. It's me and my 93-year-old mother who lives with me. I didn't think he could do anything like that. A letter that I wrote regarding a particular kind of air conditioner he wants us all to start putting in as the old ones expire. Why? Because they've been in the office condos for over 40, the office documents for over 40 years. When I questioned it, he asked me to write a letter. I did. He didn't like the letter that was addressed to the board. He told me not to bother to write any more letters because he would, quote, file them in the garbage.
Okay, so Sabah, my first, and this is Donna, my first question to you is, how many members are on your board?
At the moment, only five, including him.
Okay, so you have a five-member board. You have a personal conflict with one member of the board, and it happens to be an outspoken president, and this is unfortunately not an unusual circumstance. And I hear about this occasionally, and my first recommendation would be to stop dealing with this particular member of the board and deal with the board as a whole.
He has blocked me. He won't let me speak to them or write a letter to them.
Well, you can certainly attend board meetings. Are you a unit owner?
I am.
Okay.
I tried at our last board meeting at the end. I asked one of the only two people who turned up, well, including him, three people. I asked if there was a way I could contact any of them because he's blocking. And they said no. It all had to go through him, and it's not going to happen.
Well, Sabah, it's not going to happen from what you've laid out, but if you're at a board meeting speaking to the entire board, you don't need to ask them how to contact them further. You're speaking and they're right in front of you at that point. So my recommendation would be, and again, you have to address what's on the agenda, but, you know, it sounds like you definitely have an issue here. I urge you to keep going to board meetings to try to engage in respectful dialogue. And who knows, when this individual's term is up, maybe he won't be returned to the board.
If only. All right.
I guess that's about the only hope you have then, right?
Go to the board meetings, get the other board members involved. If they won't give out their email addresses or contact information, and that's their right, she needs to address the issues right at that meeting when she's in front of them. You can't be blocked from the meeting unless you're somehow creating a problem at the meeting and they have to remove you where you can't. So, and that's never my recommendation. I know you're frustrated. I can hear it in your voice, but you know, there's a couple things you don't want to do. You don't want to stop paying your assessments. You don't want to become, the problem that the rest of the board now believes that you're the problem, not the president. If this president is as much of a rogue, as you say, then time will tell. You just keep going and be respectful and lay the issues out there. And if he's truly as rogue as you say, unless the rest of the four board members are also equally rogue, they'll see it.
Donnie, with so much experience with associations, tell us what one should look for in a board. Perhaps you're buying a condo or thinking of it. Should the board be a consideration? Should you do homework on the board before getting involved in some place that might be a hotbed of a lot of controversy?
Okay, so I realize we're on radio and people can't see how wide I'm smiling at that question. If only for associations that have televised board meetings, if a potential purchaser or tenant could look at that and see, it might give a great snapshot into the community. How does the board communicate amongst themselves? Is the meeting well attended? Is there a level of respectful conversation amongst the board members and between the board and the owners in resident, in attendance, or is it a free-for-all? You make a good point. It is a really telling situation if you could sit and as an outsider and look. Unfortunately, as a potential purchaser, you're not a member and you are not entitled to attend a board meeting. So when you say do your homework,
but you could ask, and if they say no, maybe that would raise some questions.
You could certainly ask your purchaser and say, have you ever attended a board meeting? When's the last board meeting you went to? How did it go? How many people showed up? Are there any issues? You can also look and search the court dockets and see if the association has been the subject of litigation, either as a plaintiff or a defendant. You're going to be in the community looking at the property you're considering purchasing. Look on the elevator. Look in the bulletin boards. If there's signs that say recall the board, it's probably a red flag that you have an issue.
We're speaking with Donna Berger. Our topic are condominiums and homeowners associations. We're going to take a short break and be back with more. And we're back. It is today's topical occurrence. Joseph Cooper with attorney Donna Berger. And we're talking about condos and homeowners associations. And Donna, you also write a blog that some people might find helpful.
I do. It is www.communityassociationlawblog.com. And you know, I've been writing that blog for over a decade. And just when I think I've run out of topics, something new comes up, whether it's drones or Google Glass, or I recently blogged about communities and possibly trademarking their names and logos. So,
well, here's something that's in the news quite a bit. Animal designations. How does that affect condo associations?
I assume you are talking about emotional support and service animals.
Right. And the difference.
Well, it impacts them greatly. Condominium, cooperative, and homeowner associations are considered housing providers under the Fair Housing Amendments Act. And as such, they need to make reasonable accommodations for handicapped individuals, handicapped residents in their communities. And that could be a tenant, it could be a guest, or it could be an owner. Boards need to understand that these animals are not pets. They are reasonable accommodations for disability. Residents need to understand that most people know when you're lying and you're faking and you're saying that you need this animal when you really don't. And we see that much more often in the emotional support animal arena than in the service animal arena. Service animal under the ADA, the Americans with Disabilities Act, is either a dog or a miniature horse. And
now
it
what's
has
with this miniature horse business?
You know, I'm not quite sure.
I saw that in the material.
I wanted one as a child just because it looked cute, but I'm not quite sure what skills that a miniature horse has, but under the ADA, it qualifies as a service animal. But a typical service animal is one that's been trained for a specific disability, whether it's a vision impairment, mobility, hearing, a seizure dog. A support animal is a much more gray area. It's just, I have an emotional disability and I need this particular animal to feel better. I had a recent case, a partner of mine is handling a case where an individual claims he needs statues in his front yard to feel better. So we're seeing this really, the boundaries really being pushed.
Yeah, how far does it go?
It can go as far as the courts will allow it to go. The pendulum has swung very far in favor of people requesting these things without taking into account the needs of people who bought specifically in no-pet communities, who may have allergies to animals, who may have phobias or fears about animals. So, you know, at what point are you protecting one set of rights and completely disregarding another set of rights?
And you also might be inviting trouble if you question someone about the validity of their claim of service animal.
Absolutely. You have to be very careful. This is one area where you don't want to go it alone as a board. You want to reach out to experienced legal counsel when you get these requests.
Okay. Next, we have Luis in Miramar. Hi there.
Good morning or good afternoon. How are you today?
Good.
Hi, Luis.
I'm going to try to summarize my question, complaint, and comment. I've lived in my community for the past 10 years. Precedent has been the same for the past 10 years. I was absent for about 5 years, came back, and I'm still having some issues in trying to deal with, resolve some neighbor issues.
The condo or HOA, Luis?
I'm sorry?
Condo or HOA?
HOA, mm-hmm. Homeowner Association. My neighbor, who we're not very friendly to each other, never have been, he holds very long parties, 6 p.m. until about 2:30 in the morning, very loud, boombox, and it's escalated to a DJ. So I have brought it out to the attention of the president several times verbally. In the meetings, our attendance in the meeting is very poor. There's 3 board members and maybe 2 owners that come to the meeting, some one of them. And I have brought it out to his attention many, many times. He doesn't do anything. So I decided to send him an email, copy the other 2 members, the manager of the association, and I stated that I am now at the point that I am frightening for something bad to happen between my neighbor and I, which I'm not going to initiate. But I have called, you know, the law enforcement several times to shut down the party.
Okay, so Luis, I understand where you're coming from. You have a neighbor. Do you have attached party walls? Are you a single family home?
It's a townhouse.
A townhouse. And attached, an attached or detached townhouse?
It's attached.
Okay. So you have an attached townhouse. Your neighbor has loud parties. He's disturbing your quiet enjoyment of your townhouse, correct? Board has up until now not gotten involved. Okay. I understand your frustration. The board is probably wondering whether or not this is a situation where they should get involved. Is there another neighbor on the other side of the noisy neighbor or just you?
The neighbor next door joins the parties of the neighbor or
okay,
the so guy next door. So they're in cahoots there. They're in union.
Okay.
They utilize the back
Well, I mean, I can tell you that actually makes it harder for the association to take on your cause. Typically, when I'm, you know, when I represent an association and we get a nuisance complaint, which is what this is, my first question is, how many owners are impacted by this? And when the neighbor on the other side says, no, this isn't a problem, now it becomes a he said situation. So it's problematic. You've got a couple options. One, you can certainly take legal action directly against your neighbor without trying to get the association to do it on your behalf. There's nothing that would prevent you from go ahead and filing suit directly against your neighbor. Obviously, it's not going to make for the best neighbor relations, but you don't have great relations now. Otherwise, I would also suggest you contact your county and city. If he's violating local codes and ordinances, they may be willing to get involved. So good luck.
Thank you so much.
Okay, thanks for your call. We move along to a Dania Beach caller. This is, forgive me, Kimon or Kimon?
Kimon. Thank you, Kimon. Joseph. I appreciate this program. Thanks. Again, you know, we don't allow bullying in our schools, and but here we are in a homeowners association, a single-family residence, and the board members, and one particular, is a very big bully. And it's so bad that the neighbors don't come out to even talk to each other anymore. The only time we speak to each other are in the grocery store when we run into each other. And I wonder, you know, as a person with disabilities and taking care of an elderly parent, even bringing up issue as far as disabled parking, it's shut down. Who do you turn to? Should an attorney be involved? I don't know what to do.
Okay,
anymore.
So this is like the show for bad board members, bad presidents today. You know, again, it's terrible to hear these stories, and a bad president can definitely set the tone for the community. As you indicated, people, there's not a real feeling of community. I venture to say people don't attend the board meetings all that often, and who knows what your attendance is like at the annual meeting. That being said, don't give up hope. You know, if things are truly as bad as you point out, Kimon, then certainly your neighbors are seeing the same thing. And I don't know how many people live in your community, but I will tell you this. There's nothing that prevents a sense of community from an individual such as yourself fostering a sense of community if your board isn't doing that. So whether it's getting to know your neighbors better, and I'm not suggesting that you do this to create a revolt, but if you do need a revolt to shake things up and get a new board there, the starting point is getting to know your neighbors first. You certainly can't make progress as separate islands. You all need to get to know each other. If the situation is as bad as you say, then there's a simple solution. Vote this president off and vote somebody else in. But it's going to take, you know, one person can make a difference.
Well, I appreciate that.
Good luck to you.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks for your call. Well, let's see. Board presidents, here's one for you, an emailer. A recently dismissed lawyer for the association is now representing the former board president who was discovered having sticky fingers in association funds. The lawyer has been reported to the Ethics Commission. How else can I make people aware of this danger?
Well, your emailer is describing a conflict of interest. How else can they make people aware? You've got to be very careful.
If the association dismissed the lawyer, and then this lawyer is representing the board president, the former board president.
which can be a conflict of interest, and you can make a complaint with the Florida Bar if you believe there is a conflict of interest in the representation. In terms of disseminating information, regardless of who you are, whether you're a frustrated association member like the callers we've just spoken to, or you're a director who's frustrated with a person living in the community who's creating mayhem, you have to be very careful how you disseminate information. You don't want to be inflammatory. You don't want to be defamatory. You want to make sure you just lay the facts out.
Okay, another phone call. This is Carlos in Miami. Hi.
Good afternoon. I have a comment and a question. I am a former condo owner for over 20 years, and what I find not only in my association, but in quite a few that I've spoken with, is usually individuals on the board are elderly, retired, and may not have the ability to grasp what's going on. And what happens is you have these property managers basically running the association, telling the board members on purchases and items and probably illegal activity that they're conducting as far as business. And they went as far as to even deny me to a meeting because they said that I was not allowed to speak to the board. This is the property manager commenting to the board. I ultimately had three issues with him, which I ultimately won all three. They lost, and I ultimately ended up selling the unit. And I feel that that was going on 10 years ago, and it's going on today. And my question is, I have a friend of mine who lives in a condo. It's actually the townhouse. They're attached. And the board has issues as well, and they're telling the unit owners they're no longer paying for the insurance that insures the building, and that legally they don't have to.
Okay. Well, Carlos, you have brought up a number of important issues. So let's start where you started, which was you have a board. The board has abdicated a lot of control to the manager, I think, or it could be that the board wants to convey that impression. You know, you don't know what the dialogue is that's taking place. Sometimes managers are tasked with being the bad guys, and it's really the board that's directing that, as opposed to a manager coming in and making these unilateral decisions. And I'm not saying that never happens, but that's not often my experience. Often it's the board that wants to use the manager as a buffer or use them, and perhaps the manager will go ahead and comply with those requests, and it's never a good idea. In terms of insurance, if you live in a condominium, 718.111.11 of the Florida statutes clearly outlines that the association has the responsibility to properly insure the building in the common areas. That's not an option, and every set of governing documents also further outlines that. So if anyone out there is living in a community where the board has said, we're not going to insure the building and we don't have to, I say pick up the phone and call the Division of Condominiums immediately and ask him to look into it.
Okay, thank you very much.
Okay, Carlos, thanks for your call. Let's take a short break on our program. We'll be back with more. And we're back. Joseph Cooper with today's topical currents, along with attorney Donna Berger. She's a shareholder in the Becker and Polyakov Fort Lauderdale office. She's a blogger and an expert in condo and association issues. Donna, how about the pros and cons of self-management versus professional management? Of course, it would depend, I suppose, on the size of the building.
Sure. If you're looking at a high-rise on the ocean, I think the reasonable expectation is that that property is going to be professionally managed. It's just the responsible thing to do in terms of, covering the full array of amenities that are being offered in that community. There's a lot. That would be a lot for a volunteer board to try to self-manage. Any community in Florida can self-manage, regardless of size, regardless of budget. But again, from a managing expectations standpoint and from a practicality standpoint, when you have a large community with a lot of amenities, professional management is almost a given. even smaller communities with fewer amenities find professional management to be helpful because it's sort of a buffer. You know, we talk about some of the callers before that there's real issues in these communities. You've got to collect assessments, you've got to enforce the rules and regulations, and often volunteer directors don't want to be on the front line with that. So having a manager is helpful. That being said, you don't want to abdicate too much of your control because boards still need to be involved. The best run communities have involved boards. So in my community, I live in a community that's been self-managed for 2 decades, but we don't have a lot in terms of amenities. And I still think at times we could benefit from professional management, but we have a board that's very involved and they're willing to put in, you know, 25 to 40 hours a month in running the community. In most communities, you can't find volunteer directors who want to be that involved.
I bet they play it pretty fair and square with you in the building.
You'd be surprised.
Here's an emailer. I currently own a co-op unit in Fort Lauderdale. The unit doesn't have a washer dryer in it. I'm willing at my own expense to install it and have the unit appropriately plumbed to do so. The board, however, refuses to allow me to do so. This has become a liability for me in renting out the unit or selling it because the modern standard is to have a washer dryer in the apartments. He says he can't believe the board won't let me install. Is this legal?
It depends on, is it legal if the documents prohibit the installation of washers and dryers, or installing those individual washers and dryer would require tapping in, materially altering the common elements? The answer is yes. The board turning you down is legal. Here's the thing.
It has
thing,
to be
though.
Vented somewhere, I
well,
suppose.
Exactly. You're going to have to tap into the common piping. But here's the thing. The fact that you bought a unit that didn't have a washer and dryer and probably at some point passed a common laundry room should have been your first tip-off that this was the setup of this particular building, okay? And if renting out was your goal, then perhaps that wasn't the best consumer purchase decision you've ever made. And yeah, it's funny, when my sister was looking for a condo, same thing. We went into one unit and it had no washer and dryer, and she turned to the realtor and said, "Can I install a washer and dryer?" To which the realtor said, "Oh, absolutely." To which I said, "Oh, absolutely not, because there's not one in here and it's going to require you to materially alter the common elements." So unfortunately, whoever wrote the email probably bought in a building that wasn't the best fit for his long-term goals for the property.
Okay, so there's not much choice there. And another caller, this is Susan in Hollywood. Hey, Susan.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Thank you for accepting my call. My question is this, and there are two, actually. We were assessed last year for a new roof, which we paid. There are some units that are not paying. Now, after the work was completed just a few weeks ago, they're wanting to assess us again for situations that supposedly came up out of this renovation, which were not foreseen. So they're wanting to assess us again for another huge amount, plus lump on to that other expenses for cement work for prices that seem outrageously expensive. My question is there a way to audit the company? I believe the company is not operating honestly.
Okay, so you'd like, Susan, you would like to get a little more information about the contractor that did the project, if I'm understanding you correctly. The contract would be open and available for inspection to any owner, any member who wishes to take a look at it. Once you had the information of who did the project, you were certainly able to vet that company on your own. The underlying question here is whether or not, if I'm hearing you correctly, is whether or not the board can specially assess you several times. And the answer is typically yes. The statute doesn't speak to this. It's really document driven. So the starting point is, are there any controls or restrictions in your governing documents that would require the board to seek membership approval for a special assessment? Sometimes that's tied to a dollar amount. Assuming there is no such constraint and it simply says the board has the ability to pass special assessments as needed, then yeah, if your board didn't foresee certain things or things came up and now they need more money, they're going to have to go back to the well. As for owners who aren't paying the special assessment, I would hope that your board is moving forward expeditiously to collect those amounts from those delinquent owners.
Mm-hmm. Now, to be able to, is there a way to audit this management company? Because quite frankly, I don't believe that they are providing the services that are listed I mean, they list small services such as termite, and services such as these for $200 here, $300 there, which I have never seen done. I believe the management company is skimming off the top. How do they? What can I do?
Well, here's my recommendation. First of all, it's no different than vetting any other vendor. You're certainly able to look at the contract. You're certainly able to do your independent investigation on any vendor or company. Look and see if there's been complaints filed with the division, if there's been complaints filed with the Better Business Bureau. But I will tell you that often association members, it's easy to second guess the vendors who are selected. And sometimes you're right. You may be absolutely right. This may be a terrible company. But often members will say, why didn't you choose this one or that one? It's important to remember the board's not tied to a standard of perfection. They're mm-hmm. people. They're not going to be perfect. They will make mistakes, just like we've all made mistakes selecting our own vendors for things we personally contract for. So they're tied to a reasonableness standard. So the issue is, was it reasonable to hire this particular contractor or vendor with the information they had at the time? And my best recommendation for you, Susan, is get on the board. Then you can be at the table when decisions are made when it comes to selecting vendors, hiring and firing.
Okay. Now, you said division of condominiums?
Yes.
What is that for?
You live in a condo, Susan, in Florida?
Yes, I do.
The Division of Condominiums is a state agency which oversees condominium owners and cooperative owners and mobile homeowners in the state of Florida. They have a compliance division, a Bureau of Investigation for Complaints. They also provide education, and they provide arbitration services as well. So if you aren't aware, you pay $4 into it. If you aren't aware of it, I suggest you go online and poke around and see what they offer.
All right. Now, just one last question. If I wanted to look into the management company, where would I go to have them?
Well, the department, managers and management firms are licensed in Florida. They're regulated in Florida. So the Department of Business and Professional Regulation has the information on those licenses.
Department of Business?
And Professional Regulation,
okay.
The DBPR.
Okay, thanks. We have to run.
All right, thank you. Thank you very much for your time.
Thanks,
okay.
Susan.
Okay, it's Topical Currents at your service. Another short break. We'll be back with more. And we're back. It is Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper and attorney Donna Berger. We're talking about homeowners associations and especially condo associations and taking your calls and emails. Donna, you mentioned during our break that you're surprised that it doesn't seem any board members call or board presidents call in to talk about the difficulties of being in that position.
Yeah, where are all my board members? Absolutely. It'd be nice to hear from some of the people actually surveyed on boards. I served on my own homeowners association board for 1 2-year term. It was quite enough for me, I will tell you, because I do this as a living. But, you know, it can be a thankless job. And this is not in any way to discount any of the problems we've heard about thus far. But it would be nice to hear from the board members out there, about what your jobs are like and how much participation you get from the members in your community, let alone appreciation.
You have to hear a lot of gripes.
Yeah.
And
Everyone has an opinion. We talked about that. I mean, you selected, this roofer, but, my cousin does roofing, so maybe you should have hired him.
You could have had a much better deal. Right. And we move along to our calls. We have a lot of people on the line. Patty and Dania, hi.
Hi, a first-time caller. I'm calling regarding the emotional support animals. Our community has been limited to pets under 25 pounds, one pet. And recently, of course, we've had to accept people in with emotional support animals, which is great. I'm not a problem with that. But they're all over 60 pounds. So some of these dogs have been aggressive. I have a 15-pound dog. That's why, I still living in this community. And would it be okay to ask the board to pass some kind of a rule that at least if they're going to have the big dogs on the property, that they could wear a muzzle while they're on the property? Because one of those dogs gets loose, my dog is toast.
Yeah, and do you live in a multifamily building?
Yes, it's a condo. We have 427 units, spread throughout the property.
Okay, but so you have to get in elevators, you have common
corridors. No elevators, no. There are two-story condos that they're, you know, just buildings, you know, spread throughout the property.
Two-story, so. But you're in close contact with your neighbors.
Okay. You know, last night a dog passed me that was up to my waist.
Right.
But,
you know, you point out a very big problem that we have. Unfortunately, as I mentioned at the outset of the program, the pendulum has swung very far in favor of people making these requests. In the past, we would try to put weight restrictions or carrying the animal, if it was a no pet building, through the lobby or using a service elevator as opposed to a passenger elevator where you might have somebody mm-hmm. who has a fear of that dog. Requiring muzzles, remember, the Fair Housing Agency, the local authority, does not see these as pets. They see them as accommodations for handicapped individuals. That being said, they need to be reasonable accommodations. So my recommendation to the board in your community would not be to pass a muzzle, but to, for any emotional support or service animal who has displayed aggression, to have them removed because it's no longer a reasonable accommodation.
Okay, but in the event that even, you know, all dogs have teeth, so maybe, you know, sometimes a dog just doesn't like another dog, and so that they, you know what I'm saying, then it's too late for me because my dog's dead.
You well, what I'm it can happen amongst, small dogs can fight amongst each other, but I understand what you're saying, that your dog versus
yeah,
a larger dog.
Small right. dog, small bite, you know, big dog, big bite.
Right.
You know, so I don't have, my point is I'm being discriminated against now because my dog doesn't have a chance in here if there's a fight.
Patty, as somebody who owned a very scaredy cat boxer, I understand your issue. It's unfortunate, though, because your board cannot take the position that a larger dog is going to hurt your dog. If it's a service or support animal, it has to show aggression where the board can say this is no longer a reasonable accommodation. It just can't be the fear that it's going to happen. And I know that's not the answer you want to hear. My point to you would be to try to minimize as much as possible the contact with those larger dogs and to make sure that your board is on top of any dogs that do start displaying aggression.
Yeah, but then it's always, you know, my word against someone else's. If it happens to me, then, you know, I mean, who is the witness? Do you know what I'm saying? I mean, I'm walking my dog at, you know, whatever time of the day.
And you're right, and that's why in Bark Parks there's an area for smaller dogs and an
right.
area for larger dogs. And unfortunately, we haven't caught up with that in these multifamily buildings where now the housing agency is saying you can have a German Shepherd as an emotional
right.
support animal.
Well, basically,
okay, Patty,
I mean, we're being punished for following the rules.
I don't disagree.
Okay, Patty, good luck.
Thank you, bye.
All right. And let's go to Larry in Ives Estates.
Hi, I have been a board member. I was when I first moved into my association 20 years ago. At some point, I actually took over because everybody said, hey, we're going to quit again. And so when we decided to all quit, a new group came in, and the continued problem seems to be just a basic agreement on what the words of the documents in the condominium say. People are very ignorant if they even possess a copy of those documents and often lose their rights or have their rights trampled upon just because they don't know them. And now, in my case, I have four different issues with them. I've won one without having to go to court because I've read the documents. There's another one related to electrical, which is something I was hoping maybe you could address, because I know generally electrical and electrical distribution is not covered as a limited common element or a common element unless it says specifically in the condominium docs that it is. They're coming back at me saying that it's not covered, and I'm saying here are the words. And
right.
So, you know, I'm back to another case where I've got to sue or threaten to sue, get an attorney, over a couple $100,
mm-hmm.
and that's generally what these things are.
And when was the last time your board or your community updated your governing documents?
We did it after the hurricane, like 9 years ago.
Okay.
And you know, we live in a precarious situation. Our condo was being built in the '82 crisis, so it was being built in a fire sale. So we have five separate condominiums and a master association. Everyone has a complaint. Everyone has an argument. There isn't resources to go around. We were hit hard by the mortgage crisis.
Well, Larry, let me stop you because I do want to answer your question. You point out a really significant problem when it comes to shared ownership lifestyle, which is the fact that everything is tied to the governing documents. The governing documents create a contract between the association and the owners. And if you can't understand those documents or the board is unwilling to seek a legal opinion to properly interpret those documents, you can have people going off in all sorts of wrong directions. So you're absolutely right. Your documents may say one thing, your board may say we read it differently. And again, most of this is tied to the fact that these are developer-created documents and they're not terribly understandable. They're not written in plain English. They're often written in legalese. And if your board's not willing to get a legal opinion, then unfortunately, as you pointed out, sometimes it takes the owners hiring legal counsel to interpret the documents and showing the board the error of their interpretation to get things done.
We're down to like 5 pages of actual matter that matters to us. You can break this down, you can knock this down, you can have this size dog, you have to maintain your fence, you have to park. So but the problem is they won't come together, and this is a common problem of everyone's, they won't come together and say, okay, let's go over this and write some actual rules other than the rules that were written 28 years ago, which still include children under 12 cannot be a residence of the association.
Well, and there was a Supreme Court. There was a Supreme Court ruling over the summer that talked about disparate impact and rules and when it comes to housing. So it is important. And by the way, 9 years is not, that's way too long to let your association documents go without being touched. The laws in Florida change every single session, and there is no way that associations should go longer than 2 to 3 years without freshening up those documents. Doesn't mean you need a total rewrite, but you need some oversight. I recommend. I know you got off the board. I get back on.
Okay. No, I have to agree. And then I want to say I worked in the field many years ago, late 80s or early 90s, and your expertise is appreciated and is well known.
Great. Thank you so much, Larry.
Okay, thanks for your call. So, Donna, let's address this updating, particularly of government documents on your association. What should be looked at first?
Well, one of the things we're looking at in all these documents is whether or not exists Kaufman language. Kaufman language is tied to a seminal case in Florida called Kaufman v. Scheer, and it's whether or not the governing documents for a particular association automatically incorporate all subsequent changes to the pertinent statute, whether it's 718, 719, or 720.
Could you put that a little clearer?
718 is the Condo Act, 719 is the Cooperative Act, 720 is the Homeowners Association Act. Those laws are changed each year, and the question is whether or not the changes to the statutes then are incorporated into the association's governing documents. So when you're looking to enforce something in an association, you're going to look to your governing documents, but you're also going to want to see whether or not what's found in your documents in any way conflicts with what's found in the statute. And the statute is ordinarily going to prevail, take precedence, unless it specifically defers to your documents. So again, it's all tied to when boards come to us and say, what can we do in this situation? We have to look and see what's in your documents. So keeping those documents up to date and making sure that they comply with the statute are crucial.
Well, it's certainly been an interesting hour. My apologies to the many callers we couldn't get to. We'll have a program on this topic very soon, Donna, when you can come back. Donna Berger is an attorney with the Becker & Polykoff Fort Lauderdale office. And tell us more about that blog. People can get more information and contact you through there.
Oh, thank you, Joe. There's a lot of great resources out there. For the people who called and couldn't get through, I take questions on my blog. It's www.communityassociationlawblog.com. And happy to answer your questions.
Well, thank you very much, Donna.
Thanks, Joe.
And that wraps up today's program. Our producer is Richard Ives. Technical direction from online producer Paul Leary. Free audio archive and downloads are available at our website, wlrn.org. And also, we have links, photos, and information at the Topical Currents Facebook page. Again, apologies to those callers and emailers we couldn't get to. Join us for tomorrow's program at 1 o'clock. We'll begin with Keith Rolag, who's written What to Do When You're New, How to Be Comfortable, Confident, and Successful in New Situations. Of course, Linda Gassenheimer joins us. We'll hear the fascinating story behind the famous South Miami-Dade produce stand called Robert Is Here. The name has baffled countless motorists. Also wine guy, Fred Tasker on board as well. Joseph Cooper here. Thanks for listening. Stay tuned for Here and Now, next from NPR News.